Hello everyone and welcome. Today it's great pleasure to have our guest Ole Martin Sturmoen. He is a PhD candidate in the research group on security and defense at NUPI in Norway, and he is also an external candidate at PhD candidate at our university. His research area is foreign and defense policies with an emphasis on Norway. It's great pleasure to having you, Ole. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
And today we will discuss influence of Ukrainian war on the Norway's security strategy, let's say more specifically, and maybe broadly on the Nordic countries, if we have time. And I would like to take here the floor to ask the first question. How has the invasion of Ukraine in 2022 impacted Norway's security concerns?
Well, the short answer to a big question is that it has really upended the relationship with Russia. At the moment, there is very little hope for improving the relationship through dialogue or through creating some interdependencies and cooperation that used to be a big part of the Norwegian sort of outlook for how that relationship should develop. Now it's very antagonistic, and there is very little dialogue on the political level between Russia and Norway. But at the same time, a lot of the other sort of cooperative arrangements have sort of stopped working, besides some of the most long-standing and sort of most important agreements that Russia and Norway has when it comes to fisheries, to search and rescue, and to sort of the border management. Those remain because both countries have strong vested interests in keeping these arrangements going. Mm-hmm. Besides that, the relationship is, I would say, colder than it's ever been. And that is, from the Norwegian perspective, that is based on the fact that the sort of vision for creating a more sort of peaceful and cooperative arrangement with Russia seems to be collapsing, based on the impression that the Russian state is a revisionist state that is willing to use military force to force its will upon neighboring states. So the 2022 invasion has severely damaged the relationship between Norway and Russia, and Russia is now seen as a potential threat to Norwegian security.
Yeah. Great points. And still interesting that despite the threat, certain critical areas, there is still a cooperation between the Russia and Norway in the critical maybe security. Let's say the saving, as you said, the navigating the sea and stuff.
Yeah. So and these are sort of the high points of the cooperative relationship is these agreements, especially when it comes to the sort of the border issues and fisheries. And there's Norway has joined most of the sanction regimes from the West, besides a few minor details that is specifically tailored to keep these arrangements going. So there are still a few ports in the northern parts of Norway that allow Russian fishing vessels to sort of unload their catch, and so there are sort of symbolic things that are still operating as I would say as a tool to keep the most important agreements going. But besides that, Norway has by and large followed all the sanctions that the rest of the so-called West have imposed on Russia.
Great. Okay, a lot of new information, to be honest, for me, especially Russian-Norway relationship, and especially during this war times. Could you provide us, and also for our listeners, a little bit more background about this relationship?
Yeah, it's a sort of a you need to have the historical background to understand why Norway is at least in the Norwegian self-perception, there's this thought that Norway is particularly well positioned to manage a relationship with Russia. Norway was remained neutral during the First World War, and in the Second World War, as many people would know, we were invited by the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And that really crushed in a sort of Norwegian tradition of trying to stay out of great power politics and to remain a neutral power. And after the Second World War, that meant that Norway sort of had to pick sides.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a vigorous domestic debate about what way Norway should turn, or whether it should go into a Nordic sort of neutral alliance. But in the end, Norwegian politicians ended up with joining, looking west and joining NATO. But by doing that, they also crafted sort of a domestic political compromise between the sort of the, let's call it the left and the right, where Norway joined the alliance, but at the same time joined in a way where there was room for Norwegian self-determination and sovereignty, meaning that Norway would, to a large degree at least, craft their own approach to how to manage the relationship with then the Soviet Union and then later Russia. That meant that Norway would not allow nuclear weapons on Norwegian mm-hmm. soil, no basis for foreign troops, and also a lot of restrictions on Allied military activity on close to the border with Russia. And this policy was sort of a balancing act where you had the deterrence, which was being in NATO and being under the sort of the US-led nuclear umbrella, mm-hmm. if you like, trying to balance that deterrence by not provoking the Soviets and later the Russians, basically trying to signal that we have no intentions of being a launching pad for any attack on the Soviet Union or Russia,
mm-hmm.
And that we are very interested in crafting a peaceful and functioning relationship. And this sort of tradition has remained. These restrictions are still in place to this day, but the ambitions or the visions of creating some kind of growing, interdependent, interconnected economic and political relationship has collapsed. And I would say that collapse has been ongoing since, 2008-09, and then deteriorating from 2014 and onwards.
Almost, yeah. And great that you also connected the last part also 2014, because it's also my follow-up question, because everyone takes always 2020 as if it is the beginning, but for me it's always in light of the 2014 invasion, that initial invasion. How did Norway initially respond? And do you perceive any contrast in Norway's defense strategy between 2014 and 2022?
Norway sort of joined the other European countries in condemning and joined in many of the sanctions, the sanctions regime that came into place in 2014 after mm-hmm. the first Russian invasion. I could say that was the starting point for a real deterioration in the relationship between Norway and Russia. That being said, Norway still had a political relationship with Russia on the political level, where Norwegian ministers would meet Russian ministers, and it was the relationship was not as good, but it was not as bad as it is now. That has been a sort of developing situation. But at the same time, in 2014 was when sort of the narrative started to shift, where the Russia as a threatening neighbor, that idea started taking hold,
mm-hmm.
and also led to discussions of having to increase Norwegian defense budget to be prepared for even more deteriorated relationship. When it comes to sort of the defense strategy, the strategy is very much tied to being a NATO member and being a neighbor to the Russian submarine bases in the Kola Peninsula up north.
Mm-hmm.
So Norway's position Norway's at least assumption that Norway could be threatened in a great power conflict is based on the fact that Norwegian territory is really close to the vitally important Russian submarine bases,
mm-hmm.
and the assumption there being that in case of such a conflict, that the Russians would take northern parts of Norway to secure their own bases. So the strategy has remained the same, but the threat perception has changed considerably since 2014, and obviously even more so since 2022. It's the perception that the Russian state is actually willing to use military power. That being said, it's there's no feeling of imminent threat in Norway, I would say. It's more the feeling that Norway has is an ally that will have to support the other allies in case of a conflict, especially in regards to Finland and the Baltic states and Poland and the countries that feel more threatened.
Very interesting point, especially in the perception of the threat from 2014 and 2022. And speaking on the defense budget, there is also a debate about the Western countries supplying Ukraine with outdated weapons. Sometimes we hear this about Germany, about France, even sometimes the weapons from France is even rejected by the Ukraine. They say, okay, this doesn't have any counter-offensive capacity or capabilities. So what are your thoughts on this? Is Norway also upgrading its military capabilities, like with the modern weapons, while providing Ukraine with the outdated or old Norwegian weapons? Or is it actually other way around? How is the situation in Norway's defense?
This is a really, it's a complex and a nuanced discussion. So in general, I would say many Western countries, what they deliver to Ukraine is, a lot of it is old, but I wouldn't use the word outdated. Mm-hmm. Because even though the equipment is old, it's still very much useful for the Ukrainians.
Of course.
And another thing here is that let's use Norway as an example. A lot of the material that has been given to the Ukrainians are that equipment is old, but it's what we have. Mm-hmm. So there's no alternative in giving a lot of new stuff because we don't have that. Mm-hmm. And this is the case in many Western countries, is that if you are going to give equipment and ammunition and for artillery and whatnot, if you're going to give that in some quantity, it has to be old stuff because there is not a lot of new stuff. Mm-hmm. And when that equipment or ammunition when that's given to Ukraine, a lot of the new stuff that is being bought to replace the old stuff hasn't materialized yet. It's mm-hmm. just orders.
Yeah.
For future production that is not happening at a very high rate. So a lot of the stockpiles in many Western countries are far below what they should be. In Norway, for instance, it's no secret that a lot of the stockpiles are really low because most things have been given away to Ukraine.
Okay.
But at the same time, a lot of the equipment is very old, but it's still useful for the Ukrainians. But then you also have examples of very state-of-the-art stuff being given to the Ukrainians when it comes to air defense. Even the F-16 fighter jets that the Ukrainians are so slowly starting to use now, they are very capable platforms that most countries of the world would see as a real
game changer
and exactly, asset. Yeah. So. Not like Norway, for instance, have donated F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, and those are being replaced by the F-35, which is perhaps the most advanced aircraft in the world. So it's not like a lot of the Western countries are giving away useless stuff. These are things that the Ukrainians really need, and without the donations from the Western countries, they wouldn't
survive.
No.
Sometimes, actually, what you highlight is a very good point that what Europe has, of course, the old stuff, because there hasn't been war in Europe since the Cold War.
Yep.
And if we don't include here the missions in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, or any other African countries or in the African continent. So in this regard, sometimes I feel like it is also difficult for the European governments during the peaceful time to justify the increase in the defense budget. But right now, I feel like Ukraine is also used as here kind of a case study, easily to justify increasing the defense budget. So let's say in the Netherlands, I remember that it took a lot of year to convince the government, and the negotiation went a long time for the F-35s. But right now, if they want to increase the budget, not in the Netherlands, I mean case, but overall the European countries, you can see the budget increase, parliament confirms, people, taxpayers are not saying anything, that why suddenly we increase the budget. So the necessity is kind of is created by using the Ukraine. Yeah. Otherwise, this wouldn't happen, I feel like. What is your own? It's kind of a political tool for the defense ministry, I feel like, now.
That's probably true. And it's also... The thing is that when it comes to sort of defense acquisition, it always happens too late when the sort of the threat has materialized. But at the same time, most countries are using the Ukraine war as you say, as a justification for increasing the defense budgets. That being said, the defense budgets in many European countries hasn't really increased that much.
Despite the war, you mean?
Yeah, despite the war. So a lot of countries are still far below the sort of the 2% threshold that NATO has said should be the minimum minimum sort of benchmark for what you should spend on defense as a percentage of GDP. Norway's percentage is still below 2% GDP, and same for a lot of other big European countries. Okay. So it's being used as a way to justify more spending, but a lot of the spending is still not happening. And there are several reasons. One is that what should you spend them on? The new European defense industry is producing at their maximum capacity. It can't really produce all the stuff that people want to buy. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that a lot of European countries have really built down their defenses in a big way since the end of the Cold War, and you can't just increase those kind of structures overnight. It takes a lot of time. And it also takes a mentality shift to actually do it, like in Germany with the Zeitenwende that everyone is talking about. A lot of big words, not really much Zeitenwende in practical terms, at least yet. And of course there are also people that would be skeptical of using that the war in Ukraine as a sort of a tool to increase defense spending. And another thing worth mentioning here is that everyone trying to buy new stuff at the same time also increases the prices a lot. There's a lot of inflation in the defense, sort of the defense industry, that you can ask, is that are those companies using the situation to inflate their prices, or is it a reflection of the underlying costs of producing these things?
That's a very good point, especially I feel like the biggest winner in the case of this catastrophe are the military defense industry and companies, especially in the United States.
Definitely.
When I look at their stock or the income and then let's say how they are doing, to be honest, you can really see that the American military companies are the biggest winners of this war right now. Of course, also Iranian, because of Russia, Korean, North Korean, and the other companies as well, also winning. But in the Western side, I feel like that's the military companies. And speaking on the future of the war, as we enter the third year, how do you, what are your expectations of this third year of the war? What might be a game changer? What are your thoughts about this? Because now a lot of speculation is going on regarding the elections, as you know, in the United States, also other parts of the Europe. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I don't like making any predictions, but that I think making predictions is a bit inescapable in a situation like this. There are a lot of moving parts in which it's very hard to predict how things are going to turn out. Obviously, if President Trump gets a second term as president, that would create a lot of uncertainty of U.S. support for Ukraine, U.S. support for Europe, and also Europe's capacity to support Ukraine as a consequence of lacking U.S. support. When it comes to sort of the situation in the war itself, it's no secret that the Ukrainians are struggling at the moment because of a lack of ammunition, mm-hmm. and also because they are faced with a sort of a formidable onslaught by the Russian army,
mm-hmm.
that have lost a lot of soldiers in their attempt at sort of claiming territory in eastern Ukraine, and it obviously is grinding down on the Ukrainian defenses. So for at least for the foreseeable future, I would say in 2024 for the Ukrainians, it seems like it's a case of trying to hold their ground and defend and wait for more equipment and more ammunition to be delivered from the West and in the future. The Western sort of defense industry is slowly increasing its capacity to produce things that
more ammunition.
Yeah, and that is the thing is that the so-called West has a lot of resources and money to buy stuff for the Ukrainians, mm-hmm. but they're looking for the stuff to buy. There aren't really that much to buy, so that's the major problem for the Western donors is that there's not much left in the shop, to speak.
That's very interesting because last time I saw the Czech, if I remember correctly, the defense ministry said that I found ammunitions for the Ukraine. Plus, I read one news. I don't know how correct it was that they were looking for the ammunition also for the Ukrainians again, and the one suggestion, let's ask Turkish industry, military industry, because they can produce the capacity or join this capacity. And it was blocked by, unfortunately, France and Greece.
Okay.
That was very interesting because I was also surprised to see that while there is indeed a shortage, and which is very critical for the war and for Ukrainians and for the tale of war, still there is kind of this competition between the NATO countries. Who will get that budget?
Yeah.
Where should we direct the budget? Because it's quite a significant amount of money, and they don't want to keep it within a certain industries that it increase their political
There's always
capability.
There's always disagreements within European within the big European states on who sort of gets to produce and to win contracts. But at the same time, I wouldn't call it a problem, but one of the issues with increasing production is that the European economies are not war economies. Like we're not at a state where the governments can basically just go and seize a factory and say that okay, mm-hmm. we are at war, and now we have this factory, and you will now increase production by five times.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there.
No.
We are basically going to private companies and asking them to produce stuff, but these private companies, they operate by profit, and they make their own calculations whether it's worth it for them to open a new production line to produce stuff for an order or a contract that lasts a couple of years. So they're seeing this from a purely business perspective.
Yeah.
So for the production to increase as fast as would be needed, it would basically mean that European governments would have to go in and say that we're putting the economy on a war footing and taking over here.
Yeah,
and I don't see that as a...
It's not yet coming.
No, it's not yet coming. But it is increasing. There are increasing numbers of ammunition and material being produced, but for the Ukrainians, it's not enough. I have to say that there are some things that have happened in the last, I would say, half a year that is helping the Ukrainians is the air defense that the Western countries have provided to Ukraine, and that has made it much harder for the Russian armed forces to shoot missiles and rockets and bomb Ukrainian cities. So you have seen a tendency for the Russians to be pushed further and further away because of the air defenses and making it easier for the Ukrainians to defend against missile attacks.
Mm. Yeah. Well, fingers crossed. And thank you very much, Ole, for this interesting discussion and bringing us here the Norwegian perspective on this war. And I've learned a lot, and I hope it was also interesting debate for our listeners as well. Thank you, everyone, for listening to us today. And thank you so much, Ole, for having us today.
Thank you.